they realized he was dead.
Hassan, who was only months away from being a father, was arrested on January 8th on suspicion of a breach of the peace, moved here, and detained overnight.
It soon emerged that while he was here, Mahmoud came into contact with over 50 members of Cardiff police. The next morning, he was released without a charge. When he went home, his family say he was battered and bruised and his clothing splattered in blood. He went to bed later that same day, never to wake up again.
That raised red flags for his family, who then demanded to see police body cam footage of his detention. 1 year on, they're still waiting.
By the look of it, we're not going to be able to see the footage. But if we were allowed to see the footage, if we were allowed to see the last hours of Mahmoud's life, then we would be able to, regardless of what we saw, we would be able to move on. We would be able to grieve, but we would have a closure.
An investigation launched last year by the IOPC, the police watchdog in charge of the probe, is still ongoing. So far, it served misconduct notices to 6 officers and questioned more than 40 others. Hassan's family have criticized attempts to blame him for his own death, a reference to the coroner's report last year that Hassan had been drinking and taking drugs and gotten into a fight on the night of his arrest.
If you're from a black or African, Caribbean or Asian descent in this country, you know that deaths in custody are often followed by attempts to besmirch the reputation of the victim or the victim's family. No difference in this case. But can we just say absolutely for the record that the toxicology reports do not support that assertion?
Those supporting the Hassan family in their quest for the truth say his death is yet another incident in which a black person has died after contact with British police. For Hassan's family, closure on his unexplained death is yet to come.
Saeed Puriza, Cardiff, Wales.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a high rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most. Abdulatif Lushali, Sana'a.
Palestinians protested in front of the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. The rally was held to highlight the plight of Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence by their Israeli captors. The event comes as Palestinian prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, a cancer patient held in Israeli jails, suffers a serious deterioration in his health condition. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Abu Hamid was still in a coma and fighting for his life. During a press conference, White Society for Prisoners said the Israeli regime will be forced to release Palestinian prisoners.
The Palestinian resistance will not leave the prisoners alone and will do all it can to secure their release. Resistance factions have secured the release of over 1,000 prisoners since 2011 and will force the Israeli regime to free more prisoners. Our enemy only understands the language of force. The Palestinian resistance will alleviate the suffering of Palestinian prisoners.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits.
I have been suffering for more than 30 years while waiting for my son to be free. When he was arrested, I was 40 years old, and now I am over 70. I pray to God to keep me alive so that one day I can hold my son in my arms. Every night I cry myself to sleep worrying about my son.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors.
We are extremely worried about our sons and daughters inside Israeli jails. My son has been in jail for 7 years and I was able to visit him only twice. The situation inside Israeli prisons is extremely difficult and all Palestinian prisoners are suffering, especially due to medical negligence and the inhumane treatment.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
People here are demanding international protection for Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The demilitarized zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife. Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Shirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, South Korea.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiri, a mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist him for receiving some aids. Bishra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gozad group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S.
In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course, or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The United States conflict with Russia, which some say is self-made, has taken different dimensions. With a focus to create instability in the Eurasia region, comprised of countries like Ukraine, possibly Kazakhstan being the latest victim. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the nature of the West's new rivalry with Russia, even though it is different from that of the Cold War during the Soviet era. Geopolitical and social developments in Eurasia are becoming more like the events and alliances of the 19th and of the early 20th centuries. We're just joining us to break this down for us and give us an insight. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, joins us from London. Also joining us, Earl Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Eurasian Center, who joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start first with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, if I may. Some may say, what is a color revolution, especially in Europe? If you can please explain to us what that means in the context, of course, of recent developments.
Let me first of all say that at the beginning of 1992, the West, intoxicated by its victory in the Cold War, following the end of communism in Eastern Europe and then the dissolution of the Soviet Union, observed an opportunity to extend its political, economic, and military power by extending NATO and the European Union into Eastern Europe and also into the former Soviet states, the Baltic states, because Washington and also London were aware that by capitalizing on the demise of Soviet communism and the demise of the USSR, that would mean the West's overall power in the world would be increased tremendously. So that is why NATO and the EU expanded into Eastern Europe. But Washington and London at that time underestimated the resolve of Russia. They underestimated the resolve of the Russian people. It never dawned on them that on numerous occasions in Russian history, Russian states had collapsed only to be changed into a new powerful Russian state. Mm-hmm. So Tsarist Russia gave way to the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union gave way to the Russian Federation, which today is a superpower. But of course, the West is not finished in Eastern Europe or in Central Asia, because it is desperately seeking the admission to NATO of Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia. And also the West is attempting to challenge Russia in Central Asia by fomenting civil unrest there. So what we saw recently in Kazakhstan, in my opinion, was an attempt by the Americans and the British to strategically weaken Russia by stirring civil unrest there in the hope that the government in Kazakhstan would be replaced by an anti-Russian, pro-Western one. And ultimately, the Washington and London was hoping to create two exceedingly dangerous fronts for Russia, specifically Ukraine and Kazakhstan. Well, they failed abysmally in Kazakhstan as a result of the rapid and effective response of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. But alas, they succeeded in February of 2014 in Ukraine. And as each day goes by, as each month and each year goes by, Ukraine is integrating further and further in the West, and NATO is expanding its presence in NATO, in Ukraine, and also in the Black Sea region.
Well, since you brought up Kazakhstan, I wasn't going to talk about it as of yet, but let's move on to that then, Earl Rasmussen, and ask you what you think about the developments in Kazakhstan. First of all, we had the Russian President Vladimir Putin come out and said we need to stop color revolutions after Russia sent the troops to Kazakhstan, blaming foreign forces, actually, for orchestrating what happened there. But there's more to the story. First of all, do you agree with the fact that Kazakhstan was a victim of this color revolution? That did take place.
There's a lot of questions to be answered. There's a lot of confusion. We don't know all the facts yet on Kazakhstan. It is interesting. There's thousands of NGOs that are present. I think NED, National Endowment for Democracy, which is basically this arm of the CIO, pumped in over $1 million recently. There's over 85 to 100 UK society type organizations presence. So there's foreign presence and influence. I think it's interesting that the gas was already pre-announced about essentially like a dime. I mean, I guess we in the U.S. basis have increased over the last year, but right around.
Yeah, I'm sorry to jump in, Rasmussen.
And just before Christmas, we're getting
you in a broken up fashion. Unfortunately, we don't have a good connection with you. Let me move to you, Marcus Papadopoulos, to wrap up Kazakhstan, because I'd like to also talk about, again, Russia somewhat as a focus here. There's one source that has put, and you need to put this into context for us if you can, Marcus Papadopoulos, one source stating that there was a U.S., Turkish, British, Israeli-led coup attempt that was occurring in Kazakhstan, and there was actually a military intel operation room that had U.S., Turkey, Israeli operatives that were working out of that. If that's the case, are we looking at a concerted effort, as you started out the program, in terms of the way that the U.S. and NATO, and now we could perhaps bring Israel into the picture here, that this is what they're after? The U.S. and NATO, well, the U.S. steering this, and as you said, to destabilize these countries in Eastern Europe.
Ever since Kazakhstan and indeed the whole of Central Asia became independent at the end of 1991, the West, principally America and Britain, has attempted to stir trouble in the region in the hope of usurping Russia's position as the predominant outside force in the region. Indeed, we saw a so-called color revolution take place in Kyrgyzstan in 2005, which Russia was able to contain, and which as a result meant that Kyrgyzstan would remain in Russia's orbit. But certainly there was, during the 1990s and the 2000s, a concerted effort by the Americans and the British to challenge Russian dominance in Central Asia. And in the 1990s, inroads were made by both of them. It should also be said that the Chinese also made inroads in Central Asia in the 1990s as a result of Russian impotence at the time. But still, Russia maintained its supremacy in the region. And following Vladimir Putin's ascension to power in 2000, that dominance became all the more profound. But if the reports concerning Turkish and Israeli involvement in the attempted coup in Kazakhstan are correct, then that will have a drastic impact on Russia's relations with both Turkey and Israel. But what is for certain is that America and Britain did attempt a coup in Kazakhstan. What we saw in Kazakhstan from the militants there was very similar to what we saw at the end of 2014 and early 2014 in Ukraine, namely very well organized, very well motivated, very well led militants who were competent in the use of firearms.
Indeed.
But the CSTO met the challenge. Remember, the CSTO was created to deter, to counter foreign encroachment on the territories of the six members, namely Russia, Belarus, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. So the CSTO met the challenge, and met the challenge emphatically well.
Very well. We have Earl Rasmussen with us, unfortunately just on the phone, but let's get his take on this. Earl Rasmussen, we're talking about what has happened in Kazakhstan, and you were speaking there. Unfortunately, we didn't hear all of your statements, but please expand more for us what you were saying. And you said there are more questions than answers. But again, there are lots of details that are coming out. First, if you can continue where you left off so we can at least get a gist of what you said before.
Sure. We've got thousands of non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations that are present in Kazakhstan. I think National Endowment for Democracy pumped in over $1 million recently. So there's a lot of questions. Also, the timing is very interesting. Right near the Orthodox holidays, just before Christmas, and just prior to the security discussions between the U.S. and Russia. So I think it's very interesting timing. Whilst we also have to look at Kazakhstan, its geographical position, over 7,000 kilometers along the southern border of Russia. But at the same time, it also has access to China and is a key component of the Belt and Road Initiative. So actually, you've got, if you can cause disruption in Kazakhstan, you're basically addressing two objectives of U.S. foreign policy.
Okay, I'm going to stick with you, if I may. Again, we're seeing these details come through as to what has happened in Kazakhstan. And one of the things that is definitely true based on what the Kazakh president has said is that there were militants that were in that country, and he mentioned Afghanistan. Now, what is very interesting about that is the fact that you have Daesh terrorists that are present in Afghanistan that have sifted through, along with terrorists from other countries, but Afghanistan in particular, that has sifted through, come through, and somehow made it to Kazakhstan. We know that the U.S. was there. We know that many of these terrorists were either covertly or indirectly being supported by the U.S., the ones that were transferred out of Syria, and Iraq, who made their way into Afghanistan. So are we looking at that being the way that the U.S. is actually, at least one of the methods, of destabilization of another country by using terrorists and bringing them in?
Absolutely. I think you saw that in Syria as well. The so-called moderate rebels. I don't know if there really were ever moderate rebels. But yes. Yes, I think you'll see alliances with whatever kind of groups that have closer alliances with jihadists and with extremists. And yes, they'll use that. I mean, will that backfire on them? Absolutely, at some point in time. But they are using, I believe that there's alliances with the intelligence communities with extremists that are then causing disruption and helping organize organizing demonstrations.
Okay. Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, you mentioned that these efforts have failed when it comes to Russia. Russia is trying to make sure that its sphere is not being broken into. Obviously, the way it's standing up next to NATO and steered by the U.S. in terms of the eastward expansion, which NATO keeps doing. And it has reached a point where the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia in a press conference said this is not tolerable and said conflict may be inevitable of a nuclear nature, I believe is what he said. Do you think that this has reached that point, or are we looking at the abyss but then pulling back?
I am not one for exaggeration. I am not one for melodrama. But I will say this. The situation today in the world between America and Russia is exceedingly dangerous on account of American expansionism, of American aggression. Russian national security, make no mistake about it, is dangerously threatened in Eastern Europe. It is dangerously threatened by the West's presence in Ukraine, specifically NATO's presence in Ukraine. Even though Ukraine is not a member yet of the Western military bloc, NATO does have soldiery of its own there, and it has its weaponry in Ukraine. And the Americans and the British will continue to supply high-tech weaponry to Ukraine, which could pose a very serious threat to Russian national security. Mm-hmm. That is why Russia will use all means at its disposal to ensure that Ukraine never, ever joins NATO, because a Ukraine in NATO would pose a tremendous threat, a tremendous menace to Russia. The Russian strategic nuclear deterrent would be in jeopardy. Nuclear parity between America and Russia as a result would be disrupted. So Russia will go to war over Ukraine. Russia does not seek war. The Russian people do not seek war. Let us not forget that during the Second World War, what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War, nearly 30 million Soviet citizens died. But if need be, Russia will go to war with any country in the world to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO.
Okay, so if that's the case, that Russia would do that, and it seems like from any posturing that you take a look at, from Russia's defense minister to the Russian president to you name it, they're ready for that. The question is, the U.S. sounds that war drum, but it wants to do it through NATO, and at the same time, it says we represent Europe in a sense, even though it says we have to talk to our European partners. I'm guessing they're not. Everybody in Europe is on board. Is that a correct perspective on this, or vantage point on this? Earl Rasmussen, if you're with us, the question is for you.
I think there's a division within Europe. I think you see already the French and German foreign ministers going to Russia later this week, or within the next week. I think there's definite division. Europe has already lost almost 300 billion euro of trade with Russia over the last several years. And if the more sanctions are put in place that are being threatened, it will have huge blowback on Europe and potentially the U.S. Economically, we'd be a disaster for the world. Perhaps Russia would survive better with their alliances with China. So it's very dangerous situation, and I would agree on that. I think there's a division in Europe right now, and the U.S. is kind of dictating energy policy and economic policy and security policy without really consulting Europeans.
All right. Well, the NATO chief, and I'm not asking you, Marcus Papadopoulos, to go toe the line of speculation towards the war scenario, but the NATO chief issued a warning in that press conference hours earlier of a new armed conflict in Europe. His words, as Russia has stated, the West needs to respond to our security concerns. Of course, NATO, according to Russia and the Russian deputy foreign minister, said NATO didn't even look at our proposal, even though Stoltenberg said in that conference, we're going to send it to the U.S. anyways for the U.S. to look it over. Are we looking again at the possibility of there being a conflict, and how would that break out? Again, I know it's speculation, but that's a scenario that they're painting.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Stoltenberg, but who exactly has caused armed conflicts in Europe? Let us not forget, in 1999, NATO, led by its de facto leader, America, bombed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which violated Article 1 of NATO's own founding treaty, which clearly stipulates that the military bloc will never use force to resolve a dispute. Who caused the war in the Donbass in the east of Ukraine? By having engineered a coup in Kiev against a democratically elected government in February of 2014, the Americans, the British, and the Europeans. Russia is responding to what is happening on its doorstep. Mm-hmm. Russia cannot retreat any further. Russia cannot be silent on the matter. Sure. Russian national security is at risk. And any further increase in NATO's presence in the Baltic states, in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, in the Black Sea region, will make that menace to Russian national security all the more profound.
All right. To round this off, Earl Rasmussen, so you have these tools, you meaning the U.S. and NATO, NATO perhaps being one of the tools in the toolbox that the U.S. uses when it comes to these color revolutions, which is our core focus in this spotlight. You have the military side coming through NATO. You have the militants that we know perhaps somehow are affiliated with the U.S. in one way or another. You have the National Endowment of Democracy, NGOs such as USAID. Has the U.S. exhausted those tools as to be unsuccessful, as we saw in this latest episode when it came to Kazakhstan?
There may be more tools. I think Kazakhstan didn't have the sanctions that were placed upon them. Of course, Russia is experiencing that. But sanctions, obviously, is a major, major part of the toolbox that is being used to basically launch economic war against a target country to cause disruption. So I don't think all the tools were used in Kazakhstan, but I think it's been diverted to some degree. At least my contacts in Kazakhstan say it's much more peaceful. They feel much better now than they did a week ago. So it's Yeah, I think we've secured for now Kazakhstan, which is good, and they're aware of it. I think they're aware of the dangers on that, and we'll see what policies come out of there to better secure themselves.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. I'm glad we had you. Earl Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Eurasian Center from Washington, D.C. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you for your input. Enjoyed it. Historian, political analyst, and author from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavit Tavwe, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Reports grow of repeat coronavirus infection as experts warn prevalence among Britain's school pupils puts older people at risk. We have prepared for you an article written by Linda Geddes. The piece is titled, Without COVID-19 Jab, Reinfection May Occur Every 16 Months. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. COVID-19 infection surge in England, people are increasingly reporting catching SARS-CoV-2 for a second or even a third time. New analysis has suggested that unvaccinated individuals should expect to be reinfected with COVID-19 every 16 months on average. With winter approaching, scientists are warning that such reinfections could add to the burden of the National Health Service. Some calling for the vaccination program to be extended to all school children, including two doses for teenagers. Stephen Griffin, Associate Professor of Virology at the University of Leeds, says, if you've got high-level prevalence and frequent exposure to the virus as you have in schools, you're going to see more and more people getting reinfected despite having been double vaccinated. This time last year, the assumption was that although reinfections could occur, this was relatively uncommon, with only 24 or so recorded worldwide. We now know that natural immunity to SARS-CoV-2 begins to dwindle over time. One Danish study suggested that the under-65s had about 80% protection for at least 6 months, while the over-65s had only 47% protection. The arrival of the Delta variant of the coronavirus has further complicated the situation. Danny Altman, Professor of Immunology at Imperial College, London, says, "Certainly in the healthcare workers that we've been studying, there are many people who had moderately decent levels of antibodies, who have been, in some cases, previously infected and double-dose vaccinated, who have gone down with symptomatic infections." He added, "I think it is far more common than the kinds of numbers we were used to before." Office of National Statistics data published on 6 of October says that among 20,262 Britons who tested positive for COVID-19 between July of 2020 and September of 2021, there were 296 reinfections, defined as a new positive test 120 days or more after an initial first positive test, with an average median time of 203 days between positive tests. However, the reinfection risk appears to have been higher since May of 2021, when Delta variant of the coronavirus took over as the predominant variant. Further data from the United States, where various states have now started tracking and reporting on reinfection rates, supports the idea there is a substantially higher risk of reinfection with the Delta variant of the coronavirus. In Oklahoma, which has a population of about 3.9 million, there were 5,229 reinfections reported during September, equivalent to a reinfection rate of 1,152 per 100,000 of the population, and reinfections have risen 350% since May. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, defines reinfection as a laboratory-confirmed case of COVID-19 occurring 90 days or more after a previously lab-confirmed case. Dr. Nasreen Alwan, Associate Professor in Public Health at the University of Southampton, says, "With rising levels of SARS-CoV-2 infections in the United Kingdom, many of us are personally aware of children and adults who got reinfected, sometimes after a relatively short period from their first infection." Dr. Alwan says, "We still don't know much about the risk factors for reinfection, but the theoretical assumption that once all the young get it, the pandemic will be over is becoming increasingly unlikely." To help answer this question, Professor Jeffrey Townsend and colleagues at Yale University School of Medicine analyzed known reinfection and immunological data from other coronaviruses, including those that cause SARS, MERS, and common colds. By combining this with antibody and other immunological data from people who had recovered from SARS-CoV-2, they were able to model the risk of COVID-19 reinfection over time. The research published in The Lancet Microbe suggested that reinfections would become increasingly common as immunity waned, particularly when the number of infections was high. Professor Townsend says, "If we had no infection controls, no one was masking or social distancing, there were no vaccines, we should expect reinfection on a 3 month to 5 year timescale, meaning that the average person should expect to get COVID every 3 months to 5 years. Although vaccines are suppressing the level of infections, the United Kingdom reported 49,156 COVID cases on Monday, 18th of October. the highest figure since mid-July. Rates are highest among secondary school children, but an estimated 8.1% of this group thought to have had COVID-19 in the week ending 9th of October. Professor Townsend added, "If you allow it to run amok in any age group, then it runs amok in all age groups," adding, "The major implications are that if you haven't been vaccinated, you should get vaccinated, and if you've been infected, you should go ahead and get vaccinated anyway, because that will extend the duration of your protection." Griffin says, "If you don't clamp down on prevalence in school children, you'll get the spread of infection and possibly reinfection, which will then potentially spread to parents whose vaccines may be waning, and more critically to grandparents and clinically vulnerable people." Meanwhile, all children in the United Kingdom over the age of 12 are now eligible for at least one COVID jab, and possibly two, depending on age and other factors such as their health. But the pace of the vaccine rollout has come in for some criticism. According to official figures, jab rates among 12 to 15-year-olds are three times lower in England than Scotland, with a rate about 14% for the former and 44% for the latter. This could be important, not least because the latest data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, shows infections have shot up among secondary school children, with an estimated 8.1% of this group in England thought to have had COVID in the week ending 9th of October. However, when it comes to schools, it is also worth noting that a number of interventions have been dropped, including the use of face masks in secondary schools in England. By contrast, the Scottish Government has confirmed pupils should continue to wear face masks in school after October half-term. Professor Andrew Hayward, an epidemiologist at the University College London, speaking in a personal capacity, says, "The rates are highest and increasing most in school children, a group with intense mixing at school, no real mask use, low vaccine coverage, and minimum attempts to prevent transmission." While Professor Andrew Hayward noted this group was very unlikely to develop severe illness, Kao noted infections in young people could spill over to other groups. Kao says, "Vaccination of teenagers is likely to be more important for tracking the rise in infections due to the very high number of teenage cases right now. A very different picture to earlier pandemic waves. In the past, new variants have fueled large surges in COVID cases. The Alpha variant played a key role in rising cases last winter, while the Delta variant led to upticks in the spring. Now it seems a new variant is in play in England. More specifically, it seems this could be an offshoot of the Delta variant, which is dominant in the United Kingdom. According to the latest variant technical briefing from the United Kingdom Health Security Agency, a Delta sublineage newly designated as AY.4.2 is noted to be expanding in England, with the body noting it is being monitored and assessed. The agency added that in the week beginning 27th of September, the last week for which complete sequencing data was available, the AY4.2 accounted for about 6% of sequenced coronavirus cases and is on an increasing trajectory. However, Professor Francois Ballou, the director of the University College London Genetics Institute, says the new variant was unlikely to be behind the recent rise in cases. He says its potential higher transmissibility could at this stage only explain a tiny fraction of additional cases. He added, "It's around 10% frequency now, assuming it may be 10% more transmissible, that would only explain an additional 1% extra infections every 5 or so days.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.